4th, 2019, and both Councilor Gonzalez and Councilor Lewis are excused. They are at a council meeting of the Grand Ronde. Yes. So first kind of outreach effort. So I will ask Councilor Stacey to provide the safety briefing, since he does it with such pizzazz.
Well, I'm trying to emulate some of my colleagues who, first of all, follow the script. Second of all, stand. Please note that we are on the third floor of this building. I can't find the script. In the event of a fire or fire alarm, please exit out through the door in front of the, or next to the, I'm going to read the script. please exit out through this door in the northeast corner of this room. Go down the steps to the second floor and pass out of the building by the main entrance, by the reception desk, into the courtyard outside the building. We'll gather there and make sure everybody's accounted for. In the event of a medical or fire emergency, please start by calling 911 and also notify the security agent at the front desk. The nearest defibrillator is mounted on the steps down from the security desk to Grand Avenue. And a fire extinguisher is located in the corridor to the west of the dais, hanging on the wall.
Thank you, Councillor Stacey.
Very good.
Thank you very much. For all of you in the room just watching, we try to do that safety briefing every single time because sometimes there are a lot of folks in here who are new to Metro or even have been here a long time and may not know all that information, and in the event of an emergency, we do want to be prepared. I would encourage all staff to do that at the beginning of every single one of your meetings. It is a good habit to get into and really think through who's in the room and who may need that information, and if you even know where you would go in the case of an emergency. So thank you.
And select someone more articulate or at least can follow.
Oh, stop it. Thank you. We have three updates today. The first one I'm going to turn over to Mr. Scott, I think, to introduce a little bit about, but it's our internal performance reporting. I know it's something dear to your heart and mine, and we've got Carrie Stacey to do that presentation for us. But Mr. Scott.
Great. Thank you. Yeah, I'm going to open up, and we're going to do a couple things today. And actually, I'm going to need the, unless you want to drive. Thank you. So we're going to talk to you today. Let me start back a year ago, and one of my very early presentations to the Metro Council was on our year-end management report and our balanced scorecard report. And this is something that had been in place at Metro for a while. And you know, the goal was really sound. You know, it was to update council on achievements, management outcomes, and achievements for the entire agency, and then also the balanced scorecard contained a lot of measures to sort of give an overview of where Metro was. One of the challenges I had coming was sort of looking at the different efforts that had risen up over time and trying to see if there was a way to sort of cohesively pull them together. And I had a little bit of a hard time getting my arms around them. Each one of them individually, you could understand why it had started and why it continued, but it didn't feel like sort of a comprehensive performance management system. And so working with Martha, working with the last council, and then talking to Lynn, after the Metro Council president, after she took office and realizing how excited she also was about performance management, which is great to have that executive level support, we started rethinking the way we do this. And the goals are really the same, right? The goals are, as an organization, we need to have really clear performance measures that gauge the progress we're making against all of our internal operational goals and our regional desired outcomes as well. And I've come to you before and shown the new by the numbers tool, which is still under development, which is going to be tracking those six desired regional outcomes. What you're going to hear about today is a discussion of our operational measures internally. So all of our Metro departments, the things that we're doing on a day-to-day basis that ultimately will feed up into those regional outcomes, And those lines are not always clear, and we're still sort of working through that, and we'll be working through that over the next, 8 to 10 months. But we're just going to sort of preview with you where we are. At the same time, before I dive into the operational measures, I wanted to give a little bit of an ad hoc management report, because we have sunsetted those old tools, but I don't want you to think that Metro's not accomplishing things, because we're actually accomplishing a lot, and I think you know about a lot of them. But I want to spend just a few minutes going through a quick slideshow, talking about some big accomplishments of each of our departments over the last year. Then we're going to turn it over to Carrie and Bo, who are going to talk a little bit about the operational measures before you, and then we'll sort of wrap it up at the end. So diving in terms of our overall accomplishments over the last year, we're going to start with some of our external services departments, and we'll start with Parks and Nature. And as you know, Parks and Nature has done a lot of work over the last year, but I think development and referral of the bond that's currently on the ballot is the most significant. The development of the bond was challenging. We had to straddle a council turnover, a COO transition. We wanted to bring lots of new voices to the process that previously had been excluded. But I think the package we ended up with is really strong, and if it's passed by voters this fall, it's going to dramatically further Parks and Nature's vision for the entire region and further the work that Metro does in this area. In terms of property and environmental services, one of the major accomplishments over the last year was adoption of the 2030 Metro Regional Waste Plan. After some really extensive outreach with communities, stakeholders, local governments, and industry, Council adopted the Waste Plan in March of this year. The ambitious plan addresses important themes of equity, health, and the environment, and begins to reorient our regional solid waste system to better address outcomes with communities of color and other historically marginalized groups. The plan also challenges us to think beyond waste and really focus upstream on products during all phases of their manufacturing. Another big PES accomplishment this year, getting new contracts in place for disposal, transport, and operations, and getting 10-year contracts in place. We competitively procured over $250 million of new solid waste contracts for transport and disposal of the region's solid waste and for operating Metro Solid Waste, Metro South Station. The new contracts are expected to reduce Metro's solid waste transport greenhouse gas emissions by 8%, so achieving some of our climate goals. And while the new transport and disposal contracts continue our relationship with Walsh Trucking and Waste Management for another 10 years, both of those companies now are going to have to report on wages and progress towards our diversity goals. And the operations at Metro South Station will shift to a new contractor, Recology, who also currently operates Metro Central Station. So some really big changes and accomplishments there. And the last external, what we call the external service department, is planning and development. And a couple things just to note here. There was the completion of the Orchards at 82nd Avenue, which is a 48-unit affordable housing project. This is a transit-oriented development program accomplishment. This was originally bought in 2016 to reserve for affordable housing, and again was completed this last year, which I think shows the value of the Todd program and the value of that long-term thinking. And then we also had a regional planning accomplishment. Metro is going to be publishing a major update to the Designing Livable Streets guidelines in October of this year, culminating in a 2-year collaboration with advocates and local partners. These new livable streets guidelines are going to continue to link land use and transportation with an emphasis on designing for safety and expanded guidelines for green streets, trails, and intersections. And they're going to be available both in print form and on the web. Shifting over to our visitor venues, always a lot going on here, and not all of it, a lot of it just sort of happens without necessarily a lot of attention from MRC, which is a good thing, but it's always interesting to go back and talk to them about everything they accomplished. You're familiar with the Hyatt Regency Portland at the Convention Center. It is on time and on budget. It will be opening in January 2020. So, again, one of those things that's not getting a whole lot of attention because it's going so smoothly, but it's good to remember what a major project and milestone that is. There's ongoing work with GAPD and the Council Office on the Visitor Facility IGA. We're close. We're really, really close on this. So hopefully it's been a tremendous amount of work over the last year and a half, and hopefully we can wrap it up. Development and issuance of a food and beverage RFP, and coordinating with GAPD successful state legislation regarding blind operator participation in a lot of our venues. So I think that was a really good outcome. And then the results of our first opportunity target area hiring program, the results are really impressive. The FOTA program has resulted in African-American employment at the Merck venues at or above the percentage of African-Americans in the United States, which is 12%. So that's far above the state of Oregon, where it's just 2%, the overall region that Metro serves, which is 3%, and from what we can tell, it's the highest within, it is the highest within Metro as an agency. We have 6% agency, average agency-wide. So again, that 12% is a really significant accomplishment, and we really believe that FOTA program opened the door for African-American residents, which is exactly what it was intended to do. At the Expo Center, they budgeted at the end of the 18-19 fiscal year with a $336,000 net operating surplus. That's a $300,000 swing from the year before, and it's really especially notable because it occurred in a non-Cirque du Soleil year for the facility, as well as a fiscal year where food and beverage revenues were challenging. So it was a really significant team effort to make sure they're on a sustainable fiscal path. The Expo Center also completed the Stormwater Greenwall Plaza development, which is what's in the picture up there. If you haven't seen it, it's really neat. Captures stormwater coming off the roof. And it's led to an immediate return on investment for food and beverage sales, as well as new features and receptions for clients and patrons. So a significant step forward there. And finally, they successfully completed a revenue-generating RFP for temporary event utilities. The successful bid was awarded to Edlin Electrical. They've already approved revenue streams, provided new improved equipment, and other professional investment and expertise to the campus. Convention Center, they had 500 events in a building that's undergoing that $40 million renovation. It's really kind of amazing. I mean, I drive by every day and see the construction cranes and trucks and everything. And the fact that they're still doing, in fact, they had a record-setting year in terms of overall revenue. Enterprise revenues were up 22% from fiscal year 2018 to $33.2 million. And they successfully managed those 500 events with a pretty small number of complaints. And it was really, I mean, again, team effort, to bring in these conventions and make sure that everyone has a good experience even amidst this major construction effort. And I think what we're going to see when that's done is going to be really impressive. 93% satisfaction ratings for their service, also really impressive. So a good year, record-setting year for OCC, even with everything going on. At P5, one of their big accomplishments they're really proud of, Education and Community Engagement Initiative at P5 presented 9 student shows, 13 total performances for Title I schools in fiscal year 18-19. P5 provides free tickets and transportation so families can participate together. 80% of the students attending the shows were students of color, and they came from all 3 counties within the region. And then also only in its 4th year, P5 Presents, which is the presenting arm of Portland 5, netted a $420,000 surplus, which is going to help support their DEI work as well as their renewal and replacement fund at P5. Excluding the National Geographic Live series that they hosted, 45% of these presentations were diverse artists who would not have been presenting in P5 facilities had they not been brought in by this booking arm. So a really significant accomplishment there as well. And then I know you do hear quite a bit about some of the amazing things going on at the zoo, but just to recap, Oregon Zoo worked with partners to restore populations of 5 different imperiled native species, California condors, western pond turtles, Oregon silver spot, and Taylor's checker spot butterflies. Those are 4 species. And they released 237 northern leopard frogs. I'm not sure where they released them, presumably where they're supposed to be, from a pilot recovery program that was launched with Washington's Department of Fish and Wildlife.
University of California, Davis, does have an underground frog crossing.
Is that?
Yes. Just FYI, we might want to add that into transportation.
I did not know that. In terms of the employee experiments, they've had several successful staff conservation action trips to save lamprey and lamprey habitat. And finally, in terms of the zoo bond, it continues with a really successful run. They secured the necessary permits and broke ground on the final projects, Polar Passage, Primate Forest, and the Rhino Habitat. Those projects also remain on time and on budget.
Yeah. I don't know exactly what she's doing or where she's taking the lamprey, but the idea that we can intervene positively altered natural environment to help the species, that's incredible.
It looks like Willamette Falls.
It is.
Oh, okay.
Is it?
Yeah.
I think it's what gotten over onto the dam part of the portion.
Yeah.
Is going on.
She's sitting on the east side.
Yeah, I've been told that watching them catch the lamprey is pretty incredible. I haven't seen it live.
It's the annual ceremony.
Yeah.
Yeah. This is saving lamprey. It's not harvesting. So
it's a little bit of both. It's figuring out sustainable harvest as well as saving the habitat. And with that, any other questions, I'll turn over to zoo experts. In terms of diversity, equity, and inclusion, you're going to be later on in October adopting the C2P2, the Construction Careers Pathways Project framework, but there has been really some significant progress there. Four agencies in the region have agreed to move adoption efforts of that framework, and two additional counties have expressed interest in joining, and we're continuing to work with all of those jurisdictions on C2P2. As part of building an inclusive culture at Metro, we have launched our first ever transgender inclusivity audit of Metro internal policies and procedures to see how we can be doing a better job to support and be more inclusive with our transgender employees and the public. That report is due to Metro DEI and HR teams this winter of 2020. And then finally, in partnership with GAPD Communications and Planning, DEI launched civic engagement grants for T2020 to deepen leadership among communities of color on transportation issues. And then finally, ones you probably hear a little bit less about, but are, in my view, no less important, the support services departments and some of the work they're doing to support a lot of this frontline work that's going on out in the community. And I'll go pretty quickly through these. Asset management and capital planning, which was a new program that had just started when I arrived, it is actually going to be launched as a department next year because we've folded a number of things under it. You can see we've merged the construction project management office, fleet, and MRC operations under that program umbrella. And as a result, we're able to change how we manage over $600 million of Metro's capital assets, making sure we have consistent policies, consistent processes, and tools to manage the life cycle of all of those facilities and plan for our short and long-term investments. And then we also are continuing to make strides in how we advance diversity in our construction contracts. Case in point, as I talked about, the OCC renovation with Colas, Hatfield roof replacements with Pacific Mark and Sterling via partnership with the National Association of Minority Contractors. So some really good progress there. In terms of communications, one of the things they're really proud of, they partnered with Pamplin Media Group to create three internship opportunities for student journalists from historically underrepresented communities. The internship has yielded two articles with more in development. And in June, the communications team, in partnership with Planning and DEI, published a regional snapshot on jobs with a special focus on efforts to diversify the region's construction industry. The snapshot features eight compelling stories that illustrate how Metro Council priorities impact the lives of people throughout Greater Portland. In terms of finance and regulatory services, not to lose sight, we've talked to you about it before, but the successful sale of $652.8 million in taxable bonds for the new affordable housing program at a true interest cost of 3.32% and a $2.6 million bond premium is a major accomplishment. It is among finance geeks locally. It is still being talked about. So that's a small group, but one that was very impressed with what our team pulled off.
It's a group we like to impress,
exactly. And also the procurement centralization project was completed, resulting in better service to internal and external customers through improved efficiency of that project. Within human resources, I think one of the things we should be really proud of are the beginnings of the Employer of Choice Initiative, and Council Lewis isn't here to necessarily hear these updates, but we we've implemented our new paid parental leave policy, and just as an update, we have approximately 23 Metro employees that are on or have applied for the paid parental leave benefit, so I think it just goes to show how important that benefit is, and I have personally had a number of employees come up that I had not met before that just said, you know, thank you so much, this is making a huge difference in their lives, so I think that's really exciting.
It's the cutest picture ever.
Yes, one of our DEI staff and her adorable children. Information services, they completed replacement of all food and beverage point of sale systems to a point-to-point encrypted and fully PCI, that's payment card industry compliant system, at each of the Merck venues as well as the Oregon Zoo, so it allowed us to continue to use credit cards. Again, one of those under-the-radar things that if you fail to do right becomes a very big above-the-radar issue if we don't get it right. And we also rolled out Kronos Mobile, another under-the-radar thing, but provides the ability of all of our staff to view their time cards and complete time approvals online and remotely, while also providing future access to scheduling software, which is hopefully going to make the lives of our employees a little bit easier as well. And then wrapping up the last two, the Research Center, these are near and dear to my policy wonk heart, but the Research Center completed a historic trend and forecast analysis analytics to provide Metro Council and regional stakeholders decision support information for the 2018 UGB decision, and also completed the base condition and transport system future performance forecast analytics. I know Lynn knows what that is, for the 2018 Regional Transportation Plan on time and under budget. This first round of analysis helped to inform stakeholder discussions that adjusted the project list in the financially constrained final plan. And finally, Office of Metro Attorney, which frankly just allows all the rest of us to do our job and not get sued. But a few things just to note, some really significant legal support for the Affordable Housing Bond and Parks Bond, obviously support for the UGB decision throughout that process, continued support for the transit-oriented development agreements. They come to me every couple of weeks with, you know, really exciting things that we're doing in the TOD program, and then successfully negotiating three of our big four solid waste contracts without a single protest. So. Obviously continued good work going on in OMA as well. So what I was hoping to do was give an overview of some major accomplishments that have been happening in the last year as a prelude to what we're now going to move into, which is the discussion of performance metrics. So there's always a lot of work going on throughout the agency, most of which you shouldn't necessarily know about because, again, it's not necessarily rising up to the policy level, but it is really important in terms of supporting those policy goals. And we've talked about the regional desired outcomes. We'll continue to talk about those. And we are building the By the Numbers platform, which is going to essentially, for each one of those six desired regional outcomes, as we showed you a few weeks back, we'll have a page you can go to that's going to show what those regional goals are. It's going to show you progress that we're making towards it. It's going to allow both internally within Metro, but also the public, to sort of see where do we need to make progress and are we making progress on those things. In correlation with that, we want to make sure that all the departments that I just went through their accomplishments have operational measures and that those operational measures feed up into those regional measures. So I'm going to let Carrie talk a little bit about where we are so far. We have gathered, and you've got just a sample in front of you. We've got 9 or 10 measures from every department. We just included a couple from each of the departments as more of an illustration. But I'm going to let her talk about that process and where we're headed over the next few months.
So thank you. And the person sitting next to me, just a quick introduction, this is Bo Kapatsila. He is a Hatfield Fellow that will be helping with this work. And he comes from Ukraine as a Fulbright graduate exchange student and most recently earned his master's in urban regional planning from the University of Iowa. So he's a perfect fit for this work. And he's going to be intimately familiar with what we're doing moving forward. But what you just received from Jen and Ian is also in your packet is this subset of sample measures from our different departments. And the process that we used to gather those was just meeting with all the executive teams from the different departments and venues, asking what are you currently measuring now that helps inform your short-term and long-term decisions, and what does success look like for your different departments and venues? Are you achieving your strategies and goals? So as Andrew said, we've got an average of 9 to 10 different measures from these, from everyone, and it's a really good first step, but it also highlights the work that we have to do going forward. So Bo is going to be doing an evaluation of all the measures that we received and recommending some refinements. And at the same time, we'll be working with Andrew to create a framework for performance metric principles, concepts of outcome-based goals and measures. Bo will help with that research. And then we will go back to those executive teams at the departments and venues to work within that framework and then do a deeper dive in finalizing the measures that then we would represent to you at this time next year. With our current interim structure, with different people in different positions and awareness of all the other initiatives and ongoing work we're doing, we think it'll probably be a 6 to 8 month process. But in the end, it will improve our ability to be strategic in our work and be accountable to the public. And since Bo is helping with that regional barometer work where we're representing the six desired outcomes and by the numbers, we'll start identifying linkages where operational measures may feed into those external measures. So, for example, a year from now, if a citizen wants to see exactly how we're achieving clean air and water, they can see that our Parks Department has protected this many acres, and that helps to achieve that goal. So that's the quick process going forward.
Yep. And happy to answer any questions. I wasn't going to go through these measures in detail. I think most of them really are for management, awareness for me, for the deputy CEO, for the department heads, to be tracking progress. But happy to answer any questions. I do want to reiterate our success on these operational measures will impact our success on the six desired regional outcomes. And so ultimately, when we have a fully mature, robust performance management system in Metro, you'll be able to see, as Carrie says, you can see the acres of land being bought by parks and how that's contributing to clean air and water. You can see how, for instance, our HR, our employee engagement scores, which feels very disconnected from a regional outcome, but it's really not, right? And we know that if we can get our employee engagement scores, at or above 3.5, then we've got a happier workforce. We've got a more dedicated workforce. We've got people, frankly, who are just doing, they're more excited to come to work every day, which is going to show up in the work that they're doing, which is going to show up in those regional desired outcomes. So we'll ultimately be tying all these things together. It does take some time to build these systems.
Yeah.
So we're, again, going to continue previewing with you what we're doing and rolling it out as things move along. Ultimately, we're going to end up, the goal here, the vision is to have a system where we can easily pull out dashboards and reports. We can easily show what we're doing. We can dive deep if people want to dive deep, or we can take a more 30,000-foot view as well. I am hoping to next year to come back at the same time and have some pretty functional dashboards and reports ready to go.
I'll just jump in while people are thinking about questions. I think it's probably a little too soon, and because you only chose two that were just informative, to jump into the actual performance metrics. But what came to mind, and I think we had talked about this, and I'll just articulate it, is kind of the themes of, let's not just count acres for acres' sake. We actually want to know what the outcomes are. And so today we may only know how many acres we've saved, but in the future, we want to know what the outcomes of those acres are, right? So there's a process that we have to do to figure out what we can track today and what we want to track in the future, and we have to be patient while we build systems and thought processes around that. So there are three themes that I think are important for us to be able to get out of, like, when you come back. The difference between the accounting and actual outcomes was just the first thing. But the outcomes for Metro Council values, which you articulated in the six strategic, I forget, values.
Desired regional.
Desired outcomes, thank you. The outcomes for employees and the outcomes for customers. And there might be some other subset of themes, but I think we are going to want to know, you are going to want to know, is something internal that's trying to move things along for employees, or is there something internal that's trying to move things along for customers to meet some of those other goals? But it gets to the actual outcomes. Do we have a healthier workforce? Do we have less mental health days? Do we have programs now that are actually targeted to training for gaps that we've found? Right, because training is listed here in one category, but really it's a necessity to start figuring out where we've got gaps in training on all of the programs. So, yeah. So I think those are three themes. If somebody else has some thoughts about bigger themes to track.
No, and thank you, and that's really helpful. And one of the things that we're going to be doing when we got these measures from our departments, there are a lot of input measures and a lot of output measures and fewer outcome measures.
Yes.
And so that is one of the things over the next 6 to 8 months. One of the reasons it'll take a little bit of time is, and Bo's going to help Carrie with this, is how do we take some of those input and output measures are great, they're very valuable, but you want to always tie them to an outcome in terms of,
right,
of why are we doing the work.
Why do I care that we had 500 events?
Yes.
At the convention center? I honestly don't know. I mean, until we dig down, what does that actually mean for jobs in the industry, for the amount of money brought into the region, for the amount of minority contracting that we've done, right? Councillor Craddock.
You're getting good. You anticipate when we have questions. I appreciate your comment, because as I look in particular at the parks, so let me back up. So these are only two of multiple measures that are going to be measured. Is that right?
Yes.
This isn't all the.
No.
This doesn't include.
On average, we have about nine or ten per department. Some.
Some gave us quite a few, and some gave us a handful.
Okay.
But, yeah.
But I.
We're happy. The reason why I'm sorry to interrupt. We didn't provide all of those because we're going to be doing work on a lot of them. So we just wanted to more give you an illustration of where we are. We will be showing you all those measures later for your feedback and input, just to make sure we're on track.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Thank you. Well, as a follow-up to the Council President's comments, for example, acres protected, yes, it's nice to know that, but in reality, if we're really all about protecting water quality and habitat, we might want to know what the temperature of the water is. Are we actually really, you know, with the work that in the restoration work as we shade those streams and have more habitat or, you know, grow foliage along the streams, are we really making a difference in water quality as far as bacteria and other pollutants? And then in addition to that is, are we actually lowering the water temperature? Because that is the goal of all of this, mm-hmm. is to be able to have good fish habitat. And so I guess that's, to me, if when I think of that desired outcome of clean water and healthy streams, that's what we're heading to. And I would be interested as you move through this to BC and learn some about the specifics. Are we actually getting down to that detail?
Yeah, so that's it's a great example. The vision for where I hope to end up just a year from now, or maybe even less, you'll be able to go to the By the Numbers page, and under the Clean Air and Water Regional Desired Outcome, you'll have a number of measures around clean water. So it might be water temperature or fish habitat, et cetera. And we're deferring to the experts on what those measures are. And so you'll be able to see, you know, are the trends going up or the trends going down? And then you'll also have a link that says, well, what's Metro doing to support this goal? So that's a regional goal that is partially driven by what we're doing, but it's driven by a lot of other things as well. You'll be able to then click and say, what's Metro doing? Oh, Metro purchased 500 new acres of land to protect that water quality. And that's sort of the connection we're hoping to draw, so that the public can see directly what we're doing and how it's supporting that goal. It also drives some decisions. Even if we're doing a lot of protection of land and yet the water quality is still getting worse, we at Metro might want to think about some additional strategies that we need to put in place.
Councilor Chase?
Well, I do want to just add to the comment about the acres and following up on that, which is, I agree that we really want to kind of find the best science in terms of measuring. There might be some components where, you know, we're communicating more to the public, but I think in areas of, you know, acres protected or trail miles, for example, that could drive us away from achieving some of our goals if we're measuring acres protected and we're passing up, you know, 300 feet of riverfront because it's low on the acreage front, but very high, that's probably much higher on the water protection front. Or trail miles, you know, hey, you can get a mile here or you can get, you know, a quarter mile that all of a sudden opens something up for, you know, thousands more users. So, you know, I worry that some of the ways that we've rightly measured in the past can actually give us incentive to move away from some of the very things that we're trying to achieve. So it's just a difficult balance, and it's obviously one that's, you know, above my payroll. But but I think that we just need to be careful not to put measurements in place that actually could pull us away from some of those goals.
Yeah. I'd also like to suggest that just so you can have this conversation, I will say it out loud. There are a lot of performance metrics internally to the divisions that are important but may not make it to the top level performance metrics in terms of the most important of the most important. They might still be here and you're still tracking them, but they're important for you to do your business in each of the departments and divisions, but it's not necessarily something that rises to the top of, or do we actually have the clean air and clean clean water goals that we were trying to achieve. And I think that's a hard discussion, but it doesn't necessarily mean they're not important. It means that we have to set up a manageable system, and each department should still have their own goals and objectives that they're trying to meet as long as they're moving us towards this, right? Otherwise, it becomes really, really hard, and everybody wants their 12, or they don't feel important, and that's not the point. So I just want to put that out there, that it will be important to strategize about how to report on departments, but not make it the end-all be-all, because they're different tracking. There are different reasons for tracking different things. It's a really hard discussion internally that you're about to embark on. So I just want to...
You have done a good job of giving direction, so I don't have to say it to you.
Okay. Well, Craig just left, so should we wait? Any other things that you want to impart to us about next steps?
No, more coming in the future.
It's the timeline.
Yeah.
What is the general timeline?
So we'll spend the next 6 to 8 months working through the sort of dozens of internal operational measures to refine those, make sure we've got good outcome measures as well. And get those all in place. Simultaneously, we're continuing development of the regional barometer, by the numbers platform. And so with all those external measures, my goal, and I'm still working with staff to make sure this is realistic, my goal is that when we come back to you next year in September with that sort of look back, we'll have all of these pieces in place. So we'll be able to show you the regional barometer, we'll be able to show you our internal measures and some connection between them.
Okay, I'm going to assume that Councillor Dixon didn't have any issues. If he does, he can get to you directly, right?
Yes.
All right, thank you. Thank you, guys. Thanks for the and welcome to Metro and all of your hard work. All right, we've got up next the financial investment policy conversation with Brian Kennedy and Caleb Ford. Or just Brian.
Just me today. Council President Peterson, members of the Council, thank you for having me here today. I'm Brian Kennedy, the Interim Director of Finance and Regulatory Services, and we are going to talk about the Metro Investment Policy today. The reason for this conversation is during the adoption of the budget process, we routinely have the Council re-adopt Metro's financial policies. One of those policies is the investment policy. During that conversation, the Council President indicated that it would be good for the Council to have an opportunity to weigh in on the policy and the policy implications in the investment policy. So that is what we are here to do today. I want to note the investment policy governs how Metro invests our cash reserves. And those cash reserves are typically funds that we have reserved for longer-term capital investments or things like operating reserves for the Solid Waste Fund and the MRF venues. So to put it in context, Metro is authorized to make investments based on state law. So state law specifies what those investments are. It specifies the allocations, how much of our money we can put in certain types of investments, and the maturities, how long those investments can go. State law also requires local governments to have investment policies in some circumstances. That circumstance is if you want to invest in maturities longer than 18 months, which we do, so we have an investment policy. So our investment policy is adopted in the Metro Code as Chapter 7.03. Our actual investment transactions are handled by an external advisor. We contract that out. They monitor the market. They have the tools to actually execute those trades. It's also important to note that we have a council-appointed investment advisory board that provides oversight and advice. Side note here, on Thursday on the consent agenda, you have the reappointment of 3 members of our existing investment advisory board, Patrick Ranspott, Jonas Beery, and Damon Bleiler. They've been on the committee for a while. They're happy to continue serving. We really appreciate the advice and help they give us in monitoring our investments on an ongoing basis. So our current investment policy, again, this is Metro Code Chapter 7.03, there are four main objectives: safety, liquidity, return on investment, and legality. Obviously, safety is critically important. State law doesn't let us invest in anything where our principal is at risk. So again, with that primary objective on safety, we're balancing liquidity and return on investment to make sure we have cash available, but that we're also maximizing the return we can get to be able to provide resources to deliver on the policy objectives that the council has identified. The policy also, right now, prohibits certain types of investments, one category or certain types of securities lending that are very technical that we would never want to do anyway, so I didn't put that on the list. Our policy also prohibits mortgage-backed securities and then firms that are on the Carbon Underground 200 list.
Exactly what is that?
That's Sam and Bob's shorthand for the last time we did a review of the investment policy, being concerned that we didn't have anything that explicitly called out carbon. We were congratulated by the Cascade Policy Institute for virtue signaling, but I think what we actually did was signal that we think it's very important that the Earth survive and that we don't invest in coal and oil and other industries that are extracting fossilized carbon and filling the atmosphere with it.
So it's not a list of underground companies.
Yeah,
it's
the dirty 200.
Okay. Like underground.
Yeah. I think there are probably surrogates for investments that would tend to avoid damaging the human resources of our planet as well, and I'd be interested in exploring that as further limitation.
Okay. You want to?
Sorry.
Should we finish out this, and then we can talk about what other things we might want to add to that list and how that would? Okay.
Exactly. That is an excellent preview of coming attractions.
No, you're on. You're on.
So the last thing that's important to note is our investment policy sets asset allocations and maturities consistent with state law. So, for example, if we're talking about corporate indebtedness, our policy doesn't allow more than 35% of the portfolio in corporate indebtedness and no more than 5% in any one issuer. We are well, well below those limits. So here's a snapshot of our current portfolio as of June 30th of 2019. That's the last quarterly report that we have available. Our portfolio at that point totaled almost $1 billion, a little under $950 million. You'll notice more than 60% is in U.S. Treasuries. Part of the reason is as a matter of conservatism. We only put bond funds in Treasuries, so housing bond, natural areas bond, zoo bond funds are exclusively in Treasuries. The items number 3 and 4 on the list, corporate notes and commercial paper, those are the forms of corporate indebtedness. So they total about $16.5 million that we have in the portfolio right now. Of the overall portfolio, it's a very small number, less than 2%. Our investment advisor also separates out our portfolio bond funds as well as what they call our metro pooled funds. So that's pretty much everything other than the bond funds. So those corporate notes and commercial paper are a larger portion of kind of our more discretionary pooled funds.
And Brian, can you the local government investment pool, please explain what that is?
So the local government investment pool is a service that's run by the state of Oregon. It basically functions like a savings account, except that it offers interest rates above what you would find in a typical savings account. Sadly, the main limitation on it is the amount of money you can put in. We try to keep the maximum amount allowed, which is what you see there, about $46.9 million. I think in a lot of ways, if we could, we'd put just about everything in there because it works like a bank account. You have immediate liquidity. It's a tremendous service, and we use it to the extent allowed by law. So in terms of the corporate securities we have in our portfolio, this is a list as of June 30th, 19. You see there's a variety of firms there, technology, kind of consumer services, financial services. One thing I should note is as of June 30th, we had two positions in Johnson & Johnson in our portfolio. We have since sold those at a gain. We sold them after the judgment in Oklahoma around the opioid litigation. The interesting thing was part of the reason we were able to sell them as a gain is because the market was happy at the smaller than expected settlement against them. which is kind of an interesting perspective. So we sold them for two reasons. One was headline risk. The other reason was a concern that down the road, the credit might become, we might not be able to sell it again. So we have liquidated that position.
And can you just, corporate securities, just can you just explain a little bit what those are? Because they're not stocks. We're not buying stocks in these companies.
Exactly. They're not stocks. They're forms of debt, bonds issued by these companies. Under state law, they have to have a high credit rating, in most cases a double A rating. Oregon corporations that meet the standards, we can buy with a single A rating. Our investment advisors break the list down into two categories. One is investments that have double A ratings from at least two ratings agencies, like Standards and Poor's and Moody's, and then another list of corporate securities that technically meet the standard because they are double A rated by one of the rating agencies, but have a lower rating with the other two or three rating agencies that we look at. So in general, these are very high quality corporate bonds. The corporate paper, those are short-term investments with a maximum maturity of 270 days. And they can be very useful tools in our portfolio in making sure that we're getting, you know, slightly higher returns than we'd see in treasuries, but still help us meet our liquidity goals. So one of the things our staff does is look really carefully at, you know, for example, in the zoo bond or the housing bond, what our spending plan is so that we ensure that we have cash available when we have to make payments to contractors and to vendors. So our portfolio is laddered with some maturities, you know, there are regular maturities so that we have cash on hand where, you know, if we have a case like, say we have money set aside for compactors for the solid waste transfer stations, we know we're not going to need to do that for 5 years. So we have some of the solid waste reserves locked into a longer-term investment yielding a higher interest rate.
Question?
Yes.
So there are two categories of types of corporations in here, high-tech and real estate. Is that because they're the ones that rise to the top in terms of all of the other metrics about safety? And
it's really a pretty short list of corporations that have debt that meets the standards set by the state of Oregon. If you look at the list of debt that we could theoretically purchase if it was all available on the market, it tends to be financial services firms, technology, and then consumer services like Johnson & Johnson. Nike is on that list. But it's not a broad spectrum of firms that have debt that meets our standards.
Berkshire Hathaway is the sage of Omaha, right? Not simply a real estate company, but highly diversified, owns a
Correct.
Railroad to also owns some gas deposits, I guess. Do we do any internal screening of that kind of conglomerate?
Our screening is we're somewhat limited in the depth into which we can look at these investments. We do a screen based on the metro values. That's part of the reason we liquidated the Johnson & Johnson position.
Warren Buffett now owns both UP and Pacific Power, Idaho Power. So I guess Pacific Power isn't burning any coal in Oregon, but just curious about those relationships.
How does it influence your evidence?
Well, I think that's an excellent lead into the next part of the conversation, which is around the policy options and how we might evaluate these types of investments in the future. So we've identified four options when it comes to corporate securities that we could look at. One is clear, don't change anything. The second would be, and there are some advantages to not changing what we're doing now. The second option is expanding the prohibited investments list. In the investment world, they call this negative screening. That's what we do now. Mortgage-backed securities, carbon underground 200. So we could expand that list for other, you know, a multitude of other factors. The third option would be to limit investments in corporate debt to a list of authorized users or issuers. Some people call that positive investing or positive screening, where you have a list that you can only buy from corporations on that list that are usually screened for some criteria set by the governing body. And then the fourth option is divestment. From a staff perspective, we could implement any four of these options relatively easily, and we are looking for counsel for direction on that. I have a better graphic for this. So the fiscal impact. There are fiscal impacts from the choices you make. This shows the long-term impact, and this is kind of the most extreme case if we look at divesting, not investing at all in corporate securities. So a one-year impact. Our portfolio is around $120,000. The 3 to 5 year impact is $300,000 to $275,000. It's a little challenging to know exactly what the impact is, partially because many of these maturities, they're not out there for 5 years. So they would be maturing, we'd be reinvesting. The interest rates are also highly dependent upon what's happening in the marketplace.
Question? Could you describe what this is showing me? Because I don't know what the 120 represents.
That's
the interest that we lose?
That would be lost investment income by not investing in corporate securities.
I get it. But based against what? Because we would be reinvesting it in something else, or we're just holding it in a savings account?
No, this would be investing in treasuries, U.S. agency issues. So this is our investment advisor assessing the additional yield we get by investing in corporate indebtedness versus other types of securities.
Got it. Thank you. I just needed that sentence. Thank you.
And for a little bit of context, in the last fiscal year, our total investment earnings across the entire portfolio were around $2.9 million, which is about 1% of our total operating revenues. But I think it's also important to think about this in the broader context. We're obviously in a particular point in time with a particular interest rate environment. If you look back at fiscal year 2007 and 8, our total interest earnings, our investment income, was over $12 million and about 5% of our total operating revenues. So there have been points in the relatively recent past where our investment income has been a much bigger part of our financial strategy than it is today. And it's possible, though not likely, that it will be again in the short term. But over the next 5 years, things could change dramatically.
So put it another way, we're in a low interest rate environment, which means that the difference in terms of how we invest, these are relatively small dollar amounts given our overall interest rate. It is possible 5 or 10 years from now, we can't predict the future, that the interest rate environment will be higher and the impact of your decisions from a policy perspective will be larger. So we just want to flag that in terms of the decisions you make today. The impact will vary over time in an unknown way.
I think this came up just to refresh, not necessarily, I guess my request was based on the council's input when we were having these discussions. I think it was Councillor Gonzalez who had asked about who we were investing in, who's not here today. And Craig has actually gone home. So just FYI, he will not be joining us. He does not feel well. I think that's where this conversation was coming from, and I think maybe Councillor Stacey has some other things he'd like to put on the table, but I think it was about climate change. I think that's where this initiated. So is what we're doing enough? And then you just brought up human asset and what kind of impacts.
I wouldn't want to give short shrift to human rights violations in corporate America or internationally. When we're screening, I don't see anything that screams that in this list, but it's not presently an explicit part of our formula.
So is it, I guess the question...
I don't have any language in mind.
Yeah, no, I don't think we're at that point yet, but I think getting some basic, again, themes on the table so that you could come back with some recommendations on how we might think about doing that. So I think climate change was one, human rights, and what... Is there an existing type of criteria that others have used that we could use? And then it just occurred to me that none of these are local. How do we invest in ourselves? How do we invest back in the state? I think that's a very tiny list. But what are the actual industry, proactive industry that we would, if we created a short list of people that we invest in, we would want to invest back in ourselves, I guess.
And so, we do have a process for making investments in local banks. So we have a part of our portfolio that's invested there. I think in terms of the list of corporate securities, I think it might just be one.
One? That's the only one I can think of.
Mikey? Caleb? Yeah, so the Oregon list is one right now, which presents other issues from a potential human rights perspective. Working conditions from their contractors.
Mm-hmm. That's Apple, too.
Exactly. So the policy questions or discussion questions we framed up are, one, does the Metro Council want to change the policy direction? And then if so, how should you be engaged? The way we've done this in the past with previous councils is we've used the Investment Advisory Board and taken the desired kind of policy direction and gone back to the advisory board and had them work with us to come up with a recommendation that we brought back to the council at a subsequent point. But I also want to respect that you might want to see a range of options come back to the council. So we want to leave it fairly open for you to give direction on how we bring that back.
I would also add a fourth theme to what I just outlined, and that is investment, either proactive or, pro or con. I can't figure out which way to look at this, but those who actually support as a corporation affordable housing and those who do not. Those who work on it in a proactive way or those who are not. I don't know how to put that any other way. But there are some corporations that aren't looking at, they're completely 100% for profit and working against anything that we would want to do. So I think there's some themes to at least ask.
To explore. Is there interest, because I think it really is important that our investment policy reflect the values of our region, which is why we're having the conversation and why it evolves over time. One of the easiest solutions is, because this is a small percentage, 2% roughly, mm-hmm. of our entire portfolio, is to say, you know what, we're not going to invest in corporate securities. It opens up a whole sort of can of worms, and some companies that seem good, then all of a sudden you dig a little deeper and they're not good. And we already have a short list of who we can invest in, so it's, we don't have a whole lot of flexibility to go beyond that. So I guess one question is there interest from council to explore that option in terms of just saying, you know what, we don't even want to be involved with our taxpayer dollars. We're going to keep them in U.S.-backed treasuries and other safe deposits.
I think it would be an interesting scenario to pursue, but I'm also interested where we can invest our money to get the biggest bang for our buck. Mm-hmm. For the other values that we hold. And there are corporations that are not, and there's always a risk, but I actually personally don't want to be viewed in that move as being anti-corporation, because I don't think that reflects well on our region as well as the state. So I'm weighing how that's perceived. And we only have one Fortune 500 company. I think we should realize that there are a lot of other regions that have way more and do a lot more work collaboratively with their Fortune 500 companies. And to send that kind of signal, I think we need to think long and hard about that, even if it's only 2% of our portfolio.
Yeah, it's kind of a quagmire, because you could start going down the avenue on any of these, and they're all basically investing in heavy growth model, which is consumption-based, which is carbon footprint-based. I mean, I think about the speech that the 16-year-old Swedish woman made yesterday, and it's hard to go down this path without without recognizing where there are challenges, and I think we could dig into any of these. I like the idea of expanding the pool and seeing where we go with that, but I also, the alternatives, I'm not really sure. I don't know a lot about U.S. Treasuries and U.S. agencies in terms of really digging in deep there, but, bank deposits. Well, the bank takes our $18 million bucks and invests it. So if we're putting our money in the bank, they're investing in, I don't know, right? But, I mean, I can take a guess that it's a lot less thoughtful in terms of climate change than probably what we're doing. The local government investment pool, where we have a large source, I'm guessing it's very similar. So I actually think by keeping the corporate securities and being thoughtful about how we're investing and expanding the pool of those that we don't want to invest in, we could actually go even further with that strategy and probably have a more thoughtful effect on the carbon input that is carbon footprint in terms of where we're putting our dollars. So it's good, I think, that we're investing in those at this, the way I see it here, that we're investing in that where we have some control over where those dollars are ultimately going.
So, 2%.
Yep. Well, I know it's only 2%, and so 98% of our dollars are probably going to places that aren't as, close to our values.
Well, right. The majority are going to treasuries and then U.S. agency bonds, which I'm not going to opine on how consistent the federal government is with our values.
That's
a different conversation.
What is it?
Defense. Yeah. So, yes, there's a wide-ranging things that we can get into in that conversation.
So I'm hearing a desire to maybe go back to our investment advisory board and talk about some options. And I'm wondering, Brian, I don't know if you have a view on I can't remember, you sort of talked about the negative versus positive.
Yeah.
prohibited versus authorized. And I'm wondering maybe the authorized, this is something we can post to our investment advisory board, but the authorized list, right, might be something that council's interested in saying, yes, here are the 5 or 10 or 15 companies that we want you.
Because we can manage that list versus.
Right. And it gets us out of a little bit. I mean, the Johnson & Johnson thing was interesting, right? I mean, we wouldn't have thought that was an issue, and then it was kind of an issue. And so authorized companies can fall into that same category, but it's a little bit easier, I think, to manage in terms of that. And, we'll ask for this policy to be reauthorized every year with the budget, and so that's an opportunity as well to sort of say, okay, yeah, these we're still comfortable in these companies.
Okay. Councillor Craddock?
I'd ask Councillor Stacey a question. So you're referring to the human rights notion. I appreciate your comment, but can you elaborate on that right now, what you're thinking?
I wasn't prepared to elaborate. I just saw that as something that we didn't address last time around, and I don't know exactly where it leads us. I would say that investing 61% of our resources in treasuries is probably sensible. If we can't refinance our national debt on a regular basis, the investments, the expenditures of our government, whether you're a Rock Rib Republican or a Democratic Socialist, you know that we do have to pay our bills. we have to run a deficit at times, and it's a very constructive thing to do, and that deficit gets covered by the sale of Treasury bonds. I feel safer about that because, in the fundamental sense, we're investing in something that we as the people of America have some control over, what our government does and therefore what it borrows for. And that's more transparent to me, even if it's ugly, than some of the work that some corporations do. So I'm more interested in a negative screen on corporations. I hadn't thought about the president's idea of investing locally. And I haven't given careful thought to it.
So this, I would just sum it up, and if you have another thought to add to it in terms of another theme, it would be, are we doing everything that we could possibly do, or have others come up with new ways to think about how to deal with the carbon footprint climate change issue since we last adopted? The human rights aspect, how to think about that, if there's already a list, if there's not a list, how do we invest locally, and how do we make sure that we're investing in corporations that are pro-continuation of an affordable housing market so that we're not working against ourselves. Those are the four.
And I guess the question regarding local, does that also mean investing in our country, in our country, not just our state? When you say local, are you referring to
the state? Just talking about the corporate portion of this right now?
Yeah.
If we want to open up whether we invest, the problem is that how much are we legally, what's the maximum we can contribute into corporate, which is the highest risk, right, category?
I'm not sure if it's technically the highest risk.
It's closer.
It is among the highest, we'll say that. The maximum allocation is 35% of our portfolio with no more than 5% in any single issuer.
So if we were to move money around and say we don't want to buy into that agenda at that level, we could move things 35%. We could go from 2 to 35, but that increases risk and it increases the amount of, I think, lens that we actually have to put into this.
And some of the challenge, too, is it's not purely a decision. The asset allocation is not just about where we want to invest and the yields we can get. It's also about liquidity. And so, you know, depending on as the affordable housing bond program ramps up and we get a better idea of what those cash flow needs are, we might be precluded from some series of investments because those maturities are longer in order to keep more cash available to pay for those investments.
Good point.
I appreciate about Brian is that while he's talking, I understand it, and I don't have to take a final.
Thank you, Brian.
Thank you. So it sounds like the next step is for us to go back and talk with the Investment Advisory Board around these four concepts that the Council President laid out, and then we will work to bring back either a policy recommendation or a series of policy choices to implement that at a future meeting.
Yep.
Great.
Sorry, I thought I heard dogs howling. Who was that?
That was a bus.
That was a bus? Oh. Okay. I thought I heard my dogs howling, I guess. I just hear it in my head now. I was like, what is that? All right.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thanks for coming back. All right. We'll move into the last part of the update, which is appropriate that there were buses howling in the background. Colin Andy Shaw. And is Tyler here? Yeah, Tyler here is here to give us an update on transportation, T2020.
Good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
So thank you for the third session in 1 month on to focus in on transportation and specifically the...
Not that anybody's counting.
Not that anyone's counting. And focusing in on the program aspect of the transportation funding measure that we are working on. So just some quick reminders. We are right in the middle of a long schedule of work. The timeline that we worked out with you last January. And again, a reminder that all the little gray bubbles become shorter and the decision points come a little more rapidly as we move through October, November, December, and on into 2020. Just a quick update. We thought a very positive meeting with the task force on the 18th out in Washington County at the Beaverton Center, where the three county local investment teams all came and reported out the work they had done, and there was some Q&A from the task force. I think it was a great way to wrap up all of that work over the summertime and to begin the process of really working through projects with the task force in more detail. It was interesting to see the reaction of some of the LIT members, and some of you attended, so I don't know if you had reflections that you wanted to share with other council members as well. It was interesting to see some of the LIT members come in and see the breadth of the task force and the very large size of the crowd in the room that was paying attention to the process, and a couple commented on that as they got up there. I also was struck by how much of a team some of them had developed and how they came in and really, you know, could freely pass the mic back and forth. A LIT member who hadn't been sort of selected to go up and talk joined two of the other members on their team, and they welcomed her in, and she had some additional things to say. And you could sort of tell they had bonded to some degree over the summer. Even in one of the LITs where there was some strong disagreements, they had really grown to respect their various opinions. So.
Commissioner Therese reported that Washington County would like to continue to use the Washington County LIT.
Apparently, they may be talking about creating some kind of advisory committee with some of the members that were on that. So the other benefits of having done the work of bringing in these residents to sort of serve as a focus team on projects on these corridors. October and November are going to be some more intense meetings with our task force. We've got two meetings in October and another meeting in November to work through the process of ensuring that they get as much information as we can about the projects on these corridors, the risks, the costs, some of the high-level outcomes from those projects, working towards hopefully a November set of recommendations to the council, and we'll bring that to you in December, but of course keeping you briefed and up to date along the way. We're working on three county forums on the 21st, 22nd, and 24th of October, one in each county, to highlight projects. Are we also bringing programs through in that process?
Yeah, minimal, yeah.
And we had a very successful event. Some of you attended last spring, working with Better Business Portland. And actually, Councilor Gonzalez asked, could we do something like that in Washington County? And I think we thought, why not try to do something like that in each county to give broader exposure to the corridors, the projects, what's the discussion that's going on, and open that up to a broader discussion in each county along the way.
So you're thinking less of a town hall or just open meeting and more focused, like a panel presentation?
A panel presentation, but then the ability to interact with visuals and people and ask questions, you know, use sticky notes or stickers, other things like that to leave feedback, but have some both panel presentation discussion and some interactive elements to it.
It'd be fun.
And some of the staff in the council office have been working very hard to help put this together, actually getting sponsors for some of the events and helping to set them up in a way that will be fun, interactive, engaging. So thank you for that. All right.
Probably worth flagging, too, since Andy just mentioned that the task force meeting we just held was at Beaverton City Hall. We're also working on holding one in Clackamas County, likely in December, given the county schedule. So that is the plan there.
Where we'll be talking money.
Yeah.
Revenues. So exciting. Yes.
I find it exciting.
Good.
I think there's a comment about like nerd excitement, but I don't want to be disrespectful,
to
so I'm gonna. But it'll be very exciting. So we actually maybe this is very good.
All right. So another quick reminder that the frame for setting up these programs had been we're looking at programs that can be that can invest resources beyond what we're doing in the corridors, the specific project in the corridors, that expressly meet community needs that may be above and beyond what we're identifying as projects in those corridors. These could be capital programs. They could be programmatic expenditures, and that they're meant to advance the broader outcomes of the measure.
And additionally, as a reminder, that a lot of this is built on the engagement that we heard during the regional transportation plan, the coordinated spring engagement that we did around transportation, housing, and parks and nature in the sort of March, April, May timeframe, and the summer survey, which got up over 3,500 responses, as well as the task force's input. So these themes that you see bulleted here are the key themes that came out of our spring coordinated engagement, and they really helped shape even the sort of program concepts that were considered or given to the task force for consideration.
So we would like to propose to you that we frame this set of projects within these high-level thematics that we're addressing safety, equity, and climate action as a programmatic set of investments that would be included in the funding measure. But just to remind that's meant to be the way we talk about it. We have a lot more detailed work to do, and we walked through some of that in the last meeting. But just continuing that overarching thematic, we propose that we use that as a way to advance the overall program work.
Thumbs up.
a thumbs up with the reminder that as we use these three themes in communicating with our local government partners, we have to remember the historic confusion about what Metro means by equity, and we mean leading with a racial equity lens.
Yes, yes.
It's not county.
Geographic.
Not a geographic equity, no. That's correct. Yes. Thank you for that.
That's a very good, important point.
Yes.
Yeah. No, I appreciate you saying that. Yeah.
So can we be more explicit on here?
We'll work on that.
We can. We can work with our comms folks to figure out how to say it in a way that they support. Approve.
We always want to include low-income communities as well as communities of color, but we are leading with a racial equity lens. Yeah.
I would actually comment that both safety and equity would need some further definition as sort of a subheading, and that these three headings opens the conversation, but to be more explicit, that you know we're talking about safety in the transportation system, we're talking about racial equity across the region, et cetera. So we'll work on that and come back with more.
Just from the non-scientific polling during a campaign that I might have been part of, to get to this position, do not use Vision Zero outside of the city of Portland. Another Target Zero, zero fatalities.
Ooh, we're back.
is all good, but anything associated with what city of Portland is using is perceived in a completely different way than what it was intended. So
great.
Outside the city of Portland, it's
no deal.
Yes.
Yeah.
For sure.
So about in front of you is the list of programs that staff are recommending move forward for more development, for inclusion or hopeful inclusion in a measure. We discussed these last time in detail. There shouldn't be any surprises, hopefully, and they're included in the memo that we sent out on Friday. The one piece that I always want to flag is that strengthening communities section is the work empowering community members on each individual corridor to identify the anti-displacement and community stabilization strategies they want to pursue on that corridor. We keep talking about this in the program context, even though it would actually be funded out of the corridor piece and be connected with each set of corridor investments. But these are the other, I think we're now at nine programs are based on the feedback we've heard from council in the last two sessions proposing we move forward.
Councilor Craddock?
Were you able to make comment?
Go ahead.
I can wait until
you
finish if you want. So regarding the title of it, the fair affordability for students, obviously there's some challenges to how we shape this and make this work, but you are still officially saying this would move forward. But we have some hurdles to overcome to really make it doable.
Should we do the next slide first?
Yeah.
If we talk about next steps,
presentation.
There's just one more slide that's content. Let us just talk about next steps. That might help inform your question. Or sorry, two more.
So when we talk about moving these programs forward, it is moving them forward into development. We've done some high-level work with all of the 16 original program concepts, thinking about sort of is this feasible, what are the major challenges, but I would say very few of these nine are something that we could confidently implement in a month. We will need to do work to work with community experts, to work with other government partners, to work with folks who have a lot of maybe technical expertise in this, to figure out how to run each one of these programs individually. And so we would propose that our next phase is working on that for each of these, for each of the programs. And one of the things we'll be doing is we're looking at hosting a summit in December or January to bring together community members and technical leads together to talk about, so for some of the questions, it'll be like, what should the grant criteria be for evaluating projects? For some of them, it might be like, would you rather see lots of big projects or a few big projects or lots of small projects? And sort of helping flesh out how this really works. Some of them clearly have more work to do than others, and we'll need to do that work at the staff level. And I think particularly the ones that involve other agencies in enacting that work is going to be those will be harder to figure out, but we'll work on it.
One of the things that we did during the affordable housing bond measure was that we all agreed on the outcome and we got the IGAs later. So are we also expecting that we're not going to get 100% before we go to the ballot, but we might be 80% of the way there?
So there
and
is.
And if we're only at 50, we don't go?
Say that last part again.
If we're 50% in agreement, that risk might be too high to move forward, but if we're 80% in agreement and we just have some final things to work through.
So Margie Bradway and her team have been working on sussing out the right set of agreements to have prior to referral, and then what would be the right set of things to occur after referral.
Mm-hmm.
So we're looking at potentially some kind of letter of agreement between Metro and a project delivery agency that could occur prior to the referral. So we have some sense of how viable that set of projects are on a particular corridor. There may be different mechanisms to get agreement on longer-term things that we're trying to achieve that are either we have a whole planning process to go before we actually would invest in longer-term projects on a corridor that need additional work.
I'm focusing on the programs. Right?
Yeah, sorry, just to switch to this agreement question. So we are doing that work now. We learned a lot from the housing process. We've had early meetings with our attorneys, had some initial conversations with some of our local partners. I don't know if there's anything else you want to add to that, Margie, but work's well underway now to think through that. What do we need to do between now and May, and then what comes after that? And setting ourselves up with our local agency delivery partners to have that conversation so we all can understand who's on first.
Thank you. Councilor Stacey?
I have some comments on the program.
So last bit about time frame.
The development, yeah. There we go.
And then we're eager to get to that.
Yes. So talking about the next steps for that program development. First is digging deeper, identifying for each of the 9 programs that we're proposing to move forward, identifying similar programs at Metro and the partners who would be necessary in helping us implement or administer a program. Thinking about what the key questions are that we will want feedback from community members on, that we will want feedback from other technical leads on, and then fleshing the current information we have, fleshing it out a little bit so that they can give feedback and really help us dive into these questions. The next step is that sort of probably forum or summit concept that we've talked about, where both using our community partnerships team that we are hopefully funding a series of community partners to help us engage in this work more deeply, have their engagement and feedback, have the program summit that we talked about, and other forms of direct engagement to answer the questions that were identified in the first phase. There's been the sort of refinement time period where we're continuing to take all that feedback, using it to further hone and refine the engagement findings, thinking about things like, okay, what are the actual administrative mechanisms? Are there any sort of major obstacles that are becoming clear through this process? That is likely the time when we'll need to come back to council and say, you know, here's for these 4 programs, we think they're all going to be administered roughly the same way. It's pretty straightforward. We don't anticipate any issues. Here's one where we have 2 options. We're coming to you asking for guidance about which way you would like us to go. Here's one where we think there's a pretty significant risk. Are you willing to take that risk? Or do we need to have a larger conversation about it? And that's probably in the February timeframe, maybe March. And then finalizing the programs in time for the measure, trying to get them all to that sort of 80% space, 80 to 100% space, so that we know that we can administer them and deliver on them. Some of them, I think we will, you know, when I look at the list, 6 of those 9 are likely to be administered internally. And
the latter part of the memo, essentially.
Yeah, and I think we will be able to do that. So we might have those, you know, somewhere between 90 to 100% figured out, and others might be 80.
Okay. All right. Questions?
That's it, yeah.
All right. Councillor Stacey.
Thanks, ma'am. I guess I want to start off thematically. First, start off by congratulating you. I think this memo and the tone of the memo and the programs that it suggests are a great start to a discussion about programs. I think it's comprehensive. I think it at least responds to a lot of most of the concerns we've heard raised by community organizations and advocacy organizations. the emphasis on safety, the emphasis on climate, the emphasis on active transportation. Through all of it, of course, runs the expectation that our climate objectives and our equity, access equity objectives will be primarily or very significantly influenced by transit. And providing transit service in the right locations, at the right levels, and with the right accessibility is critical to the success of a strategy for regional transportation service. I caused a bit of a stink by passing around notes in class talking about getting transit service included as a program. And I've been taken to school both by my internal colleagues and by TriMet that under a long-standing expectation arrived at between TriMet, the business community, and the legislature, funding initiatives for transit service are TriMet's responsibility. And that because Metro could well have its own conversations with the Legislative Assembly and the business community about the structure of a funding measure, we don't want to be in a position of duplicating efforts by TriMet or surprising those community and governmental partners by having our own foray into trying to provide service. However, I'll repeat myself, the amount of transit service we can provide under this program is going to be critically important to achieving our climate objectives and our equity objectives. So I'm particularly interested in continuing to make progress on understanding something that I've been assured by TriMet is a consequence of our investment in the streets and in TriMet's fleet. When we have a bus pull through at an intersection with a far side stop and a longer green light to get that bus through, we're moving transit faster. When we buy electric buses or help with the electric bus purchases, we are making a capital investment in their system that they therefore don't have to spend fare revenue and payroll tax revenue bonding it to buy those buses instead of putting it on the street in service. So Mr. Bottomley at TriMet holds the job I held 20 years ago at TriMet, assures me that he's going to have more information about the extent to which this proposed set of investments in electrification will relieve TriMet of a capital burden they've more or less already agreed to take on, and therefore will mean more service hours. And he's agreed that he will be able to quantify that, I hope, by the forum that's going to be happening tomorrow night. I'll be celebrating my birthday at the Sweeney Neighborhood Association meeting, so I won't be there for that.
Are they
going to
have cake for you?
The day before my birthday celebration.
Wow.
Are you also spending yours at your local neighborhood association?
So I just want to emphasize that right now we have advocates for modes anxious to make sure that we can do everything we can. Yeah. Advocates for climate, who really want to see electrification of the fleet as a critical step, and advocates for better service for low-income communities and for youth, who see the same pot of money as smaller rather than larger. They all want more service, but they all want a particular outcome. I'm very sympathetic to the idea that a youth pass, not necessarily a student pass, could be a critical component of making the system more accessible to young people and therefore to existing and future transit riders. I'm happy to see, are going to study that further, work with communities, have it a subject of a forum, and I would suggest that we consider renaming it Fair Affordability for Youth. I think that's a signal that we're listening to everybody and that we're going to have information about how many bus hours TriMet can save in its current operations because we're speeding buses through, which will be a smaller number, I expect, than the diversion of fare revenue to capital investment. We're going to get a lot more fair revenue from that. But we can both grow service hours through our investments and help get more people access to the system if we keep that youth fair or youth affordability item in the program agenda and continue to develop it. So I'm all in on this thing, particularly if Bernie has good information for us this week or next about the effects of our investments on how they operate the bus. I stand on the division waiting for the number two many mornings, and darn, I waited a while. And then here comes the full bus and the empty bus right behind it. That empty bus is going to be available once we make it work faster and better to redeploy on another line that doesn't have as much frequency or on a new line that doesn't have a bus. So I want us to have a big tent, not divide the tent of participants we have over fighting over scraps. I want to grow the pie higher, and I want to make sure that we're addressing community needs and climate needs with transit service. That's my speech.
Awesome. Thank you. I think it's an interesting conversation. I'm just going to dig a little deeper, because are you excluding all students, no matter their age? Or
no, just the reverse. It's not necessary to have the credential of attending a school.
Right, so you want youth and student.
Yeah, we have a youth pass now that costs $1.25.
Yeah.
If we had a free youth pass, that would be one way to accomplish it.
So but I'm specifically asking, are you... You're saying no matter your age of 18 and below, and then student on top of that? I'm trying
like
to figure out.
Community college student or?
The population of folks that you're.
18.
If you're above 18 and you're still a student, and you could be 56. So
I don't see. I don't know how the current student fares are available to high school kids, primarily in Portland and also in some other areas. There's a discussion about how we can spread that peanut butter around more, or whether we can actually have a youth pass for 18 and below.
So I think we got to figure out who we're helping.
Yeah.
And I totally I hear you. I'm just saying we need some clarification, because for me, if you're in this region and you need to retool yourself and you're 56.
Yeah.
And you don't have a car anymore because you have to retool yourself and you're barely able to afford to live in the region anymore, you're going to want that free bus pass. So what is the population? Who are we trying to target? It's an expansion of some already good discussions, and what does that mean? Yeah, so if it's just for youth, great, but then we just missed an entire other demographic that's struggling. So, yeah.
It's we maybe also have a low-income fare already, and we've got to build that for that.
And it is worth flagging that the staff recommendation focused on students who qualify for free or reduced price lunch, so that there's an income threshold. And that was in response to feedback we heard from community members who said, we're not particularly thrilled about the idea of providing a very wealthy student whose parents could easily afford a bus pass with a free pass. Which may come later at the expense of service or being able to expand and serve others. We are really concerned about the students who are financially struggling.
We're also talking about the barriers that we're afraid of, the burdens we're afraid of imposing on school districts for sorting through who's eligible and who's not.
Mm-hmm.
And so those are the kinds of questions I'm going to see weighed, not concluded before we begin the analysis. There may be an offsetting benefit by having a youth pass so that school districts don't have a burden of determining who qualifies and doesn't on an income basis. We also have a low-income fare. And so somebody who is in a household that qualifies for the low-income fare is already going to get a price break, regardless of what school they're going to. We're talking about whether we can provide free transit for youth as one possible approach to this issue.
So I think it would be useful in all of these programs to be very specific about the type of outcomes we're looking for, because I think when we get to the implementation, there's going to be a lot more flexibility, I think, right? And how do we actually get there, or do we get agreement in your January, February summits on these are the outcomes we're trying to get to, and that those outcomes don't have just the primary target of a capital investment, but there is this secondary outcome that we're looking for in terms of transit service as a domino effect, right? So I think if we can be more explicit about that in the program outcome conversation, it'll help with the actual delivery of the program.
I certainly hope we can get the advocates to stay involved in those discussions as we go through that deeper analysis.
Yeah. Well, if we have massive summits, I think that would probably help.
Yeah.
So, Councillor Craddock.
Well, this follows up, I mean, goes back to why my comment, because this is very complex, and with Sam's leadership, the House Bill 2017 put in place a low-income fare. So, because of our limited resources, I mean, I use the word redundancy. Do we want to, you know, we have a program in place. How do we maybe take that program and make it a better use than trying to reinvent the wheel? And then based on Councillor Dirks' comment last time is we can have low-income fare, but if you don't have a bus in your neighborhood, that fare is of no value to you. So it's that cart, you know, what comes first, the horse or the cart. The fare is important. A low-income fare is important, but if there's no transit service available to you, then why have this fare? So I just want to make sure that these programs really, when we go back to the word equity, we really are creating a program that is available to everybody in the region that would deserve to be involved in that program. So I just don't want to... I want to be very careful about this and make sure that this is something that could really bring great value to everybody in the region.
I just thought of a very interesting response to the cart before the horse, which is if your systems think you need both. All right. Councillor Chase.
Well, I like the way that you're going to refine these and develop these. And, you know, I'm expecting that we may go down the road. And, yes, we're moving forward with these at this stage, but we may end up having to make some tough choices at some point. You know, how much in resources do we really plan on generating? And what are some of the, you know, it's like choosing children, right? Like, they're all great. I could articulate on every one of these why I love every one of these. What is the cost of implementing these? You know, two of my favorites, fair affordability and safe routes to school, for example. You know, is there a cost of administering both of those? Whereas if we could have tremendous outcomes by investing in one or the other. I would hate to have to choose that, but if we're actually delivering more to our community, you know, and getting more bang for our buck from a dollar, you know, I think we ought to be prepared to make difficult choices about that. I do want to throw, since it's been a topic of discussion, I do... on the fair affordability, I do think it's worth exploring a more of a youth umbrella, and it may be students and youth, because, you know, I wasn't really thinking of the older student kind of population, but there is the balance of the low-income fare. But, you know, having accessible transit for all youth would be pretty tremendous. And if you don't have to sign up for a program, the use is... you know, significantly higher. We know with the low-income fare program, we're at about 30,000 folks who are signed up on that program, and it's going to go up, and it's going to take time. But, you know, I think we have, you know, in the hundreds of thousands of low-income people in our region, right? So I think similarly with youth, I think it's worth exploring something that administratively would probably be, you know, there'd probably be some savings by making it more accessible and easier, and so there's some sort of balance there. But I do like the idea of looking at all of these a little more in depth, and I like your approach.
Thanks.
Is that it?
Thank you.
Yes.
We had a lot of feedback from you in the last couple of meetings, so I appreciate all the guidance you've given us along the way.
So at the... risk of putting out numbers that are not fully formed. I have always hoped that the projects and programs would end up with at least a 75-25 split between active transport and vehicular types of specific roadway types of improvements that are tweaks to our system but are necessary tweaks. Is that where we're falling out generally? I mean, that was my big hope, is because a lot of the other regional measures across the country were 50-50. And I know that that's not where our region wants to go. They want to be much more proactive. And if not, are we striving still in that direction, especially in the corridor work?
I would say all of these programs that
combined.
Are focused, that are focused on transportation, putting aside the housing, one, are focused on active transportation and transit.
That's the programs. Now include the corridors.
I think we're not quite ready to answer that.
Yeah, I mean,
but I want to put out a target.
The roadway improvements that are being proposed and discussed, the dollar amount is so huge that I think you're pushing that 25%.
Mm-hmm.
So I think it's up to us taking your direction to craft one, given the corridors, because there is transit and active transportation needs on almost every corridor,
yeah,
to make it 75-25. So I'd say that's helpful direction, but I can't just say yes to that right now.
No, and I don't want to put a target on yet, but I think I would say it's important to start thinking about the mix, because our targets are for active transport and GHG emission reduction and racial equity. So, you know, there will be exceptions, and I think when we get to that point, and the task force needs to make a recommendation that points out if we're substantially different and why. Because there's also a very large project in there that is just light rail and anti-displacement, right, with Southwest Corridor. So it will skew numbers one way, but there might be some other roadway projects that skew numbers the other way. It's just, I'd like to have that conversation and make sure that we're I'm sorry if I'm just competitive, that we're better than any other region. So how's that?
That's helpful. That's good feedback, especially ahead of October, November time frame. Yeah.
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 Okay.
Thank you very
Thank
much.
You.
Yes.
All right. With that, Mr. Scott, any?
I do have one quick item. So as you all know, we're focusing very intentionally on emergency management, both within the region and also within Metro. This includes providing resources and information to our own Metro employees, and Kimberly Abels is here to share some details about some of these projects and resources with you.
Swag.
And maybe even some whistles.
Council President Peterson and Councilors, my name is Kimberly Abels. I work in communications embedded with the Garbage and Recycling Program. September is National Preparedness Month, as you may or may not know. So myself and a team of other emergency management professionals around the building got together to form a cross-department cohort to kind of develop and implement a plan that we're calling the Steps for Preps campaign. The goal is to provide resources and tips to Metro employees to help them, their families, and their communities be better prepared in an emergency. We have emphasized that while the first thing to come to mind is the big earthquake, it's important to remember that these same skills are going to apply for local, smaller-scale emergencies, things like a winter storm, high heat days, or if your water main breaks and you're stuck in your house for 3 days. So over the past month, we've been pulsing out tips and resources through the Monday message and directing employees to our newly developed resources page on the MetroNet. These are complementary to active campaigns currently going on around the region through close coordination with the RDPO's Regional Messaging Task Force. So what I have for you today are some of the resources that we shared at information sessions so far at OCC, the Zoo, and here at the Metro Regional Center. This includes an emergency under-the-desk whistle to store with you and a pocket plan that I would encourage you all to flip through and fill out. Later this week, we'll be at the Expo Center, and we're working on firming up details to be over at P5 for their October engagement event, and then also at information sessions for admission staff at the Schnitzer and Keller Auditoriums. Each event so far has been really well received, and our colleagues have welcomed this information. Thank you. And we've had some really meaningful conversations. There's a really strong desire to continue this resiliency work, and if Metro chooses to move this discussion forward, both internally, we already have ideas for our next round, if we can move forward, and continue to convene groups around the region, it will be beneficial to maintain a coordinated presence, but also make sure we're keeping that racial equity lens applied. Those that are hardest to reach are often going to be the most severely impacted, so it will be critical to develop and contribute to work plans that are explicit in that approach. So we hope to continue doing that. We have a couple more ideas that we'll be rolling out over the next couple of weeks. But just wanted to share where we are with you right now, and I hope to continue to do this work, connecting with folks across the agency and across the region. And if you have any questions, I'd be happy to answer them.
No, that's awesome. The more prepared our staff can be, the better we can actually serve people in need.
Yes.
So thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks for all your hard work.
Appreciate it very much.
Councilor Communication. Seeing none. Oh, sorry. Just kidding. Councilor Stacey and then Councilor Craddock.
Oh, boy. I've talked enough already, obviously. But solid waste program has some updates for us. First of all, let me pass around the slate of candidates for the Regional Waste Committee, Advisory Committee, that we'll be asked to approve on the consent calendar soon.
Yep. Apologize. Next couple weeks.
Next couple of weeks. I'm right here. And I won't go over the bona fides of each of the proposed members. This committee will advise Metro Council and staff on implementing the 2030 Regional Waste Plan. And we expect the Committee on Racial Equity to also have a role in making sure that we do our very best work. The membership structure is intended to help ensure that the committee will focus on outcomes that best achieve the public interests that our system tries to serve. And we have individuals representing communities of color and other historically marginalized groups, an environmental advocate, a garbage and recycling system user, and local governments. The council president and the solid waste liaisons have already reviewed this. Slate will come before the council this Thursday. So please take a moment to look at the names. As a reminder, when the council adopted the language creating the new committee, we also directed staff to report back on the functioning of the committee and its membership approximately 6 months before expiration of the members' first 2-year terms. And part of the impetus for that was concern expressed by MRF operators and other operators of the solid waste system in the private sector who were accustomed to an older way of doing business where they had a vote on a committee that would then advise Metro so that they felt heard by the staff and that the staff was obligated to pass on their concerns. I've tried to assure folks in that community that I and my colleagues will undoubtedly continue to listen to the folks who are in the operation of the system. But I've also assured them that we will take seriously this admonition, that we'll look at it again 6 months before the expiration and see if we need to reconsider the composition of the overall membership. Other key solid waste dates this fall. An October 15th work session on solid waste facility infrastructure investment and priorities. We'll be looking at public services to be provided in the South Metro area as we try to make more efficient utilization of Metro South and move off-site recycling and other community services, the self-haul and other community services, and continue to advise staff on new public service station on the west side. These are outcomes from the solid waste roadmap of investments that the council, I think, first started undertaking in 2014, 15, 16, and made a lot of tentative decisions, and now these are coming forward to us as action items for investment decisions. Finally, in October 29th work session on food waste updates, the status of local government's adoption of ordinances implementing our direction that certain commercial food scraps be collected and processed separately from solid waste, one of the tools for bringing down the greenhouse gas content of garbage, the methane production from our waste disposal facilities, and getting value for biofuels and energy production out of those wastes. There are a few governments that have declined or ignored our request that they implement, and we'll be learning about our tools for implementing it, notwithstanding that a refusal.
Can I just talk to that a little bit?
Yes, ma'am.
Just having had conversations with one of those jurisdictions, I just would like to get a little bit of feedback. I think that if one of those, any and all of those jurisdictions, if they were willing to come forward with their own template of an ordinance and show us the difference between what they're implementing and what our template says, and we are the majority of agreement that this council would be interested in moving forward.
Absolutely.
And so that's what I passed on. And so I just wanted to make sure that that was something that everybody felt okay with. Because I think that if there's some small tweaks around the edges that they want to make to their own jurisdiction, we should be allowing for that. As long as they meet the major intent of the outcomes, just going back to the stream setback discussion in my head, I don't want this to become a three-year fight.
That dates you, Madam President.
I know. I'm really old. But I don't want a three-year fight about this. I don't want the heavy hand of Metro to be the heavy hand of Metro all the time. But if we can get to 80 to 90% in agreement with what our gold standard would be to somebody else's, and then kind of work with them to get to the 100% over time, I think that we're still making a lot of progress. So,
how many jurisdictions are there?
Two.
Hillsborough, Gladstone, Oregon City, and I may be forgetting some.
Three.
Sherwood? I don't think so.
Four.
I thought it was two, but it's maybe
Hillsborough,
three.
Hillsborough's legal position is that Metro lacks authority to require them to adopt ordinances.
And to be clear, this was the city of Hillsborough who was willing to take that next step and propose their own.
Yeah, and I can't speak for solid waste folks, but I think that's a great idea.
I think that's where we're going to have to start to get through this so that there isn't a heavy hand in Metro. I think that it's been interpreted by those jurisdictions of we're not going to do anything because of the threat. And if we can just take a step back,
sure,
then I think they're willing, at least one of them is willing to move forward.
I just don't want a Safeway in Hillsborough having to do something entirely different from the other Safeways as a consequence.
And I think that's up to the Safeways. I think that's up to the corporate Safeways to say we'd like one standard.
Yeah, they've already said that.
No, but right.
Yeah. So we can. Great. Great.
Okay. Yeah, so the issue isn't so much the process. The issue is more about this Metro doesn't have that responsibility or authority.
I think the perceived threat.
The president's diplomacy is very valuable here.
Okay. Thank you. We'll keep moving forward.
Finally, in October. Nope, that's it. Food waste. Yep, we're done.
Okay. Awesome. Councilor Craddock.
I have two communications. Last week was the Levy Ready Columbia meeting. This is that consortium that's been working together for the last 3 years, at least 3 years, maybe four, on looking at the working together to achieve a recertification of the levee system that connects Troutdale to Sobeys Island, or almost Sobeys Island. If you remember, in 2005, after Hurricane Katrina, the Corps of Engineers has said that all levee systems have to be recertified. And if a levee system is not certified, then those that live within the floodplain will have trouble getting flood insurance and or no insurance, or have trouble getting insurance at all. So it's really important for our region to have a certified levee system along the Columbia River. So that's what the purpose of this group has been. We really hit a major milestone or achieved a milestone this year. Thank you to the state legislature. They enacted Senate Bill 431, which created a new flood safety and water quality district in urban Multnomah County. So this is quite an accomplishment, and thanks to all the jurisdictions that have been working on this to get the legislators' support. So what this new district is, what will happen, the next steps is, first of all, we're going to appoint an initial board of directors. And this is not the official board of directors, but an interim group. Well, this group will then establish a new utility fee for this new district and regarding around maintenance and elimination, and at some point then move on to move away from the property-based tax that currently supports the four drainage districts. And then as this new group is working, they're going to develop a capital program, which would then be comprised of geo bonds and revenue bonds backed by this utility fee and then contributions from both fed, state, and local governments. So then at some point, then the new board of directors will be elected. That will be in this new district. and after these initial steps are taken. And then after that occurs, then there will be a dissolution of the current four drainage districts and transfer of all those assets over to the new utility district. So this is quite an accomplishment, yeah. And we really should pat ourselves on the back for achieving this. This new flood control district. It's there should be 12 appointments from local governments to this interim group, which will include one from the local governments and the drainage districts, and 5 appointments by the governor. It'll be a resident of the managed floodplain. It'll also include a business in the managed floodplain or in a nonprofit organization with interests of the floodplain. And then also include nonprofit with interest in the managed floodplain, and then a conservation organization and an environmental justice organization. So it really be a collective group of representatives that will be on this board. The final board of directors will be selected upon once the revenue base is established, and the final board will be comprised of 9 voting members, 5 of which are to be elected. In the urban Multnomah County Flood Control District, and then 4 positions at that point will be appointed by the governor around flood safety, environmental conservation, environmental justice, and the Port of Portland. So it's really quite an achievement, and we should be very proud of being involved in this. It's come a long ways.
It's great.
It's terrific that we, with the legislature's help, have figured out a way that Multnomah County taxpayers can pay to repair that dike, and yet the folks in Hillsborough and Gladstone and Oregon City can still use the airport.
Yes. We'll make sure the airport is still usable for them. Yes.
Yeah.
That's a good point. Yeah. I attended the Zoo Bond Oversight Committee this last week. I think it was last week. We really should be proud of the accomplishments of our zoo staff and as they move forward with the 2008 bond measure, that $125 million that the voters have given us to remodel and upgrade the facilities at the zoo. Here we are 11 years later after the bond measure has passed. And the projects are still on track to be completed on time and within budget. That completes the first 10 years of that 20-year master plan that was established right after the bond measure was passed. And so in the next 2 years, we'll be opening 3 new facilities, the primate forest, the rhino habitat, polar passage, and event space. As part of Metro's bond compliance monitoring, staff and consultants have determined that in speaking about bonds today, it's kind of interesting in the management of the bond proceeds that we are in a situation where we're going to be rebating interest earnings in excess of the debt interest. So the bonds were sold, and we've been managing those funds, but we haven't spent the bonds at the pace that the IRS would like us to spend. So we are going to be paying back the IRS $450,000. This is all the funds. We have adequate funds to do that through those proceeds. It's just that the construction hasn't kept pace with the earnings on the bond's interest. And so we're in that position. An updated Oregon Zoo Bond program equity and contracting report was issued, and which includes all the final projects. And exciting to note that they've reached in co-bid goals 14.9% for construction contracts, which is quite remarkable. So,
I think it's worth the council learning more about the bond penalty assessed by IRS.
Yeah.
It's on us to make accurate projections of how quickly we'll achieve the targeted expenditures. That's a covenant under the bonds, as I understand it. And so the tax-exempt status of the bonds gets threatened. That's probably something you'd hear about.
Can we just ask Mr. Scott to follow up on that and then come back?
Yeah, let me follow up on it. I will follow up on it. Was it a negative arbitrage situation that they discussed, or was it a spending?
If I understand, the proceeds have earned more interest than we've been able to spend off, and therefore we're penalized.
Okay.
We'll look into it.
I'll follow up.
It's an IRS rule.
I think that's a good thing to just get a clarification on. Thank you. Anything?
Just quickly, was honored to represent Metro at an opening for one of our Todd projects near the Gateway Transit. 52 units, supermajority of which are affordable, plus some desperately needed anchor headquarters for Human Solutions that provides a lot of services. Really great project. Had our natural area bond oversight committee meeting today. They are, we're getting low on dollars there, so it's really great timing to have another bond measure coming up. They are going to do their report on that. I suggested they do that, after November when we have a lot more information and they can provide some reflections about and what's gone, I think, tremendously well and how they can provide some insight into the next chapter that we take on, which I'm optimistic we will be taking on that next chapter.
Awesome. Thank you. Let me just put a couple of footnotes out there. I think that we all might be seeing more tribal council contacts into staff as well as into councilors' offices. Until we actually have a tribal liaison staff person in place, I'm going to ask that all contacts just be recorded with Paul and with Andy. We need to be able to track what's going on through the organization. Without that kind of tracking going on, you may be in an awkward position because we are not necessarily all up to speed on all of the issues that are revolving, nor are we all up to speed on the history of every single tribe and their perspective. And so I would ask for you to make sure that both Paul and Andy know so that we can make sure you have all the information you need prior to, because there have been similar experience that the city of Portland has led to some folks making promises before they maybe wanted to in the end, or being put in an awkward position that you could have avoided. So I think if we can do that as an agency, as we can do that as counselors, I am not asking that you not meet with anyone. I am just asking that we make sure that you have what you need for those meetings, if that makes sense.
Yes, ma'am.
Okay.
The tribal governments expect government-to-government relationships, and we should expect the same. And that means a consensus of the governing body. So being open to communication and not being expected to make commitments, except in the context of government-to-government discussion.
I think this is a continuous learning experience also. And we've had several tribal visits that the city of Portland has graciously included us in, which is amazingly helpful. And I think myself and Councilor Gonzalez have been going to the most recent ones. So I just want to make sure that nobody feels excluded because it really is an opportunity to learn. So as we go forward and we have more of those opportunities, we'll bring them forward. I would rather not have a quorum going, but let's see what we can.
Okay.
I mean, unless we figure out how to do that.
We've had ceremonial meetings where we were not asked to meet.
Yes, they're ceremonial, but when we go and we actually do an on-site visit, wouldn't want to get into a perception that there was a council quorum.
Right.
Yeah. So when the city of Portland invites us along, or until we set up our own formal process when we have a tribal liaison, I would just ask that all contacts be put into a central database of Andy and Paul.
And you're asking that of staff, too.
Yes, please. I think we're about to get a lot more interest in those conversations around issues related to and around Willamette Falls. The other thing I would just say is that Mr. Scott and Paul are still working on kind of a continuous learning opportunity for us with regard to what does it mean to be not white in the city and getting different perspectives so that we can learn firsthand. And I know you're moving that along, and I appreciate it. But I just wanted to give you all the opportunity to know that that is still moving along so that we can have an opportunity to hear from different folks' perspectives on, and we're going to try and find a way to structure that so that we can have a conversation and really learn from real people in the community. So if you're all good with that. Okay. Because hopefully that will inform our policymaking and our perspective on different conversations that we have. So anything else? All right. Thank you. We are adjourned.